Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Religion Prof Podcast. I'm very happy to welcome as my guest on the show today, A. David Lewis, who is the creator of comics. He's a person who studies comics, and he's been involved in a really, really fascinating comic creation project just very recently, or maybe I should say comic revival project very recently. The revival, the return from a little pocket universe, but also a return from comic hiatus to the multicolor pages that we all love, if we appreciate that genre, of Kismet, Man of Fate. And so, Dave, welcome to the show, and just really excited when I saw this project. I was glad to see so much mention of it and discussion of it popping up so many places. Thanks for taking the time to be here and have a conversation with me about your work and about Kismet.
Oh, totally my pleasure, James. It's great to be here, and I love following all the stuff you post and record also. So this is delightful.
So I know you've done lots of interviews, and I want to mostly direct people to read other things if they want some more backstory and then start digging into the nitty-gritty. But just very briefly, for those who may just be wondering, okay, I've missed this so far. Clue me in, what is this about? Say a little bit about, you know, how this project came about, you know, who Kismet is, and how you ended up reviving this character that had had a brief appearance in comic books and then had disappeared for a while.
Yeah, Kismet is not my original creation. Kismet was part of a comic book series in 1944 called Bomber Comics. It featured any number of garish and adventurous characters. The reason I became aware of the character and the property is because I was doing research on portrayals of Islam and Muslims in popular culture. And what I discovered is that Kismet was, in all likelihood, the first Muslim superhero in print in 1944. Now, there had been portrayals of Arabs before and even a few portrayals of Muslims, but not as the superheroic main character. And this really excited me, and I was really interested in it, and I was really disappointed that there were only four issues, four adventures. And then since 1944, Kismet fell into the public domain, meaning that his copyright had lapsed. The publisher had done nothing else with him. So, moving from comic scholar to comics creator, I said, I need to give this guy more of a story. I felt a real draw to do something with him. And at first, I thought the story that I was going to give him was just his swan song, was just his final story that he never really got, you know, the series finale. Mm-hmm. But I really grew to identify in some ways with the character, and in other ways just see possibilities for the character in the modern context. So I did what I call, I pulled a Captain America and transported him from World War II into the modern day, into Boston, in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings. And this gave really a huge amount of space to, we have this Algerian Muslim superheroic character from World War II that fought with Free France against the Nazis, dumped in modern day Islamophobic Boston. On your mark, get set, go.
Yeah.
And it's just been, I worked a few vignette, a few short pieces on the character, and then spoke with publisher A Wave Blue World about doing long form series with them, and they have been terrific, and that has resulted in our first print collection now, Volume 1, Boston Strong.
With more to follow, I'm gathering.
With more to follow. In fact, what I'm concerned about with the interview today is so many of my answers are going to be, oh, that's in the next volume.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're getting to that. Oh, yeah, but there was only so much we could stuff into the first volume without making it unreadable, that I have a great amount of backstory and thought on the character that we just sort of did tip of the iceberg on in this first volume, as proud as I am of.
Yeah, well, it's exciting to have a character that, you know, has really just captured your imagination and got you excited. You know, I can hear just from the way you speak about it, both in interviews I've been reading, but also, you know, today. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the subject of public domain, you know, is not one I want to focus on too much, but we have seen, you know, a number of items, you know, moving into the public domain, you know, some laws, you know, a law expiring and not being renewed. And so, you know, that process is going to continue in a way that it hadn't for a while. Mm-hmm. And so there's, it's good to think about, or at least highlight, however briefly, that there's this exciting opportunity that comes along with that. Just out of curiosity, and this is, I realize, speculative, but do you think this is a project that would have come about if you'd had to, you know, either because of potential hurdles or because of how much extra work it would have been for you and for others, if the character had not been in the public domain, if you'd had to track down, you know, permission and get permission to revive and all these kinds of things, is this one of those things where we can really say, without this, it wouldn't have happened, or it wouldn't have happened the way it did?
Pretty close to it. Yeah. I mean, you're very close to it. I did do due diligence, which is, you know, not just, oh, he's probably in the public domain. And I even tracked down the current publisher of other comics produced by the same publisher in 1944. That is to say, some of these works had been kept out of the public domain. The copyright had been purchased or maintained. And I wanted to make sure I wasn't creating a problem rather than taking advantage of an opportunity. Actually, the most popular of the works by this 40s publisher that was maintained is Classics Illustrated, which is, you know, one of those reasonably well-known comic series about how they took literary masterworks and made them readable for comic book audiences. Not to say comic book audiences can't read great literature either. But yeah, I had concerns, and I think if there were great headwinds against this, I may have gone in another direction entirely. It worked out. It was there to be done. It was, I'm sorry to do this, Kismet. That Kismet was actually available to develop and revive.
Yeah, and mentioning Classics Illustrated and, you know, series like that, you know, we're seeing, you know, I think more in our time, an appreciation of that medium, that one can put these things to use, you know, as a textbook, you know, as a way of taking scholarship and conveying it to a general audience, to younger audiences than might read it if it didn't have the illustrations and the characters, you know, with the speech bubbles saying the things. The same text can engage different people, or the same people in different ways if it's presented in these ways.
I particularly like your note that you're saying general audience and not just and not just a youth audience, although they're included. I think academia, at least in the U.S., has done a better job of moving away from canonicity, from the idea that these are the pure and unfiltered great works and you must read them in just such a way, and are instead turning to the idea of stories and then media as slightly separate things, related but not without being worth being distinguished from each other. So when you do bring images or sequential art to a work like Moby Dick, that doesn't necessarily cheapen it. It has the opportunity to enrich it, to draw out certain themes, to offer a new lens on it. What do you picture Ishmael actually looking like? What would a historical Ishmael actually look like? So it creates, I think, greater layers, you know. And one more thing that I'll say is that when I'm referring to Moby Dick or Charles Dickens, they were the pop culture of their time. The novel was the derided genre or medium. So they can't be held in this sacred space. I think introducing them to a variety of readerships in just about any form has its own worth.
So the main character, and you know, in fact the central character, the superhero character, but also those closest to him, are themselves Muslims. And so, you know, one of the things I thought would be interesting to talk about is, you know, I mean, on the one hand, I'm interested in the responses from, you know, Muslims and non-Muslims to some of the details in here, but also what's different about having a superhero for whom, you know, this is about God and providence and, you know, the supernatural in the miraculous sense, and not just either the magical or the science fictional as in some other comics. So what does the fact that he's Muslim, you know, within the world of the story mean for him as a superhero and for you as the author?
This does come right out of the scholarship I was working on. I mean, prior to this, I was working on a collection with a co-editor, Martin Lund, called Muslim Superheroes, and looking at their representation in comics with numerous contributors taking all different angles and lenses on that. What I found in the scholarship that I then tried to address in some way with Kismet is that Muslim characters were either depicted as incredibly pious and highly, highly, like almost super religious, or their being Muslim was entirely incidental. It was a throwaway, right? And there was very little to find in between. And I think part of the reason that comic book readers and a number of audience have drifted to the character Ms. Marvel from Marvel Comics is that its writer, its creative team, its editor have done a really great job of layering the character, of integrating the principles of Islam and the ethics there into her identity without that being the only element of her identity. Now, the peril that I saw, and I think I expressed this in the Muslim Superheroes book, is that while I find Ms. Marvel fantastic, I'm a fan, I'm a reader, there is the jeopardy of being of that becoming the only go-to example, right? Or readership or mainstream audiences becoming complacent and saying, yeah, I know Islam, I've read Ms. Marvel. And I don't even think the creators, Willow and her colleagues and Sana, G. Willow Wilson and Sana, I mean for Ms. Marvel to be that either. But Kismet is a response to what sort of different variations of Muslimness could be depicted in a superhero context. One of the really pleasant as well as challenging aspects of writing Kismet as a series was showing a number of different degrees and variations of Islam, particularly in America, particularly in Boston. I should say that this is not exclusively a Muslim cast, because I think that would create its own problems and concerns. I'm instead showing how Islamic ideas, principles, ethics, views can slot in, not just to society overall, but to a rip-roaring adventure story. That was a drive for me that made it worth doing, rather than just, you know, whistling in the dark. It sort of provided a motivation also for looking at the last several years in America, roughly 2014 through 2018, in terms of Islamophobia, in terms of rise of potential fascism, in terms of the Trump administration. It did line up in just such a way that this was the ideal outlet for me.
Yeah, and because I you know, when I read comics, it tends to be, you know, a lot of sci-fi and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the main reason why the Trump election does not feature prominently in things I've been reading lately, but it is central to this particular story that you tell. And so it's a natural thing to do to, if you're dealing with Muslim characters, especially one who's just dropped into the present day, you know, you right. need to engage with it. But how have readers so far, you know, reacted to this, and, you know, what kind of engagement have you found there to be around this, whether, you know, mm-hmm. resistance or enthusiasm or anything in between?
The response has been largely positive, but I'm going to put an asterisk next to that. Mm. I haven't gotten either the response of, oh, this is garbage, you know, which is nice not to have to face. I also haven't seen necessarily a backlash yet. You know, people who are terrified of Sharia law taking over, or that want to coat bullets in pig grease to make sure that Muslims die and go to hell. I mean, I haven't encountered that. What I have encountered is some people being very positive about it, which is wonderful, and I love that. But I'm not looking exclusively for positivity. We got a wonderful review by a gentleman named Greg Burgess, who's a comic book reviewer. And he gave it a fine review. I think he called it 7.5 out of 10 stars. Fine. But it launched him into this lengthy self-examination of how he feels about the political climate right now, how superheroes operate in this climate, and how he feels about Muslim characters in his stories. And I thought that was hugely rewarding. As a creator, as a scholar, if this is creating a discussion and allowing people to say, oh, I liked that, why didn't I like it more? Let me think about where that landed and where that didn't. That actually feels like, at least for our first volume, mission accomplished. The asterisk I wanted to address before, though, is that I sense, I could be wrong, but I sense a hesitancy on either the part of Muslims or the part of non-Muslims to fully throw in with the book. That there's a reluctance, not because it's good or bad, not because there's anything particularly offensive about it, but I feel like a number of readers are sort of waiting to see what everybody else says about it, and that they don't want to tie their ships to a book that I'll admit gives a range of views, not just on Islam, but on America, on Boston, on sexual orientation, on class issues. It doesn't fit neatly in a camp. And therefore, I feel people are being positive about it, but not too enthusiastic in case it is offending some other camp they're not aware of.
Yeah, because one thing I wondered was, you know, having, you know, this Muslim superhero who is devout but also is you know, very much in favor of, you know, not just inclusivity in a generic sense, but, you know, specifically engaging things like, you know, gay rights and things like that, equality. And so I did wonder, you know, about reactions to that, you know, from Muslim readers as well as from other readers. And
they have been, at least to the degree that it has reached me, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they object to things, they may not go directly back to one of the creators.
Sure.
They've been silent about it. And it might be a case of, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all about it. It might be a case of there's actually plenty of room for this in fiction, right? Or in graphic novels, whereas it may be different when addressed in everyday life. But I'm wondering what are other Muslims' reaction to this? I did want to say, I don't want to call myself Kismet's creator, not just right. because he predates me, because the character was in the 40s, but really this whole project, this whole work wouldn't exist without my artistic collaborators, without without Noel Tuazon as the artist, and Rob Cronenberg as the colorer, and Taylor Esposito as the letterer, and even Nicola Black as the designer. So if you heard any hesitancy there in how I was labeling myself, that was it. I take full responsibility for what shows up in Kismet as a character, but I can't take all the praise either.
Mm. And just out of curiosity, have you heard from anyone who knew Kismet back in the day, back in the 40s, who has read this and is, you know, reacting to it in some way?
That's a funny question, because I did get in touch, the scholar in me, had to get in touch with people that knew about public domain comics, that knew about Golden Age comics, that knew about representations of Islam during the 40s. But I don't know that they are the same audience as this book is open to. I'll say that differently. I don't know that they are necessarily picking up this book and reading it, or reading it in terms of the old school character. So again, as disappointing as this may sound, no, I haven't heard. Most people are being introduced to Kismet through this series today than I think anyone was back in the 40s.
And if somebody gets the Kismet bug and is excited by this character and wants to go read the backstories, now that they're in the public domain, hopefully it's easier, but where should they look to do that?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. Hold on, I can find it. They are all available online. I will find them. They were in Bomber Comics, as in a wartime flying bomber.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
How dare you? They are definitely online. I've even referred to them. And a number of publishers have reprinted them, so you can still buy them on Amazon and so forth. It might be Comic Book Plus. Yes, it's Comic Book Plus.
Comicbookplus.com. Okay. Well, I will try and make a point of linking to that when I share this in a blog post.
It is, they have Bomber Comics. The publisher was Elliot. It ran for 4 issues. Each issue features a different story by Kismet. And in fact, he's not really the cover. He's not the cover story for Bomber Comics 1, but he is on the cover of all the subsequent ones, which gives me the impression that his importance ratcheted up even somewhat.
Interesting. So we're both educators, and you know, one of the questions I want to get to in a second is, you know, since you've already spoken about how being an academic who researches, you know, religion and researches comics, you know, has informed being, you know, involved in the production of this particular comic. I also want to hear about how, you know, how the reverse works, you know, how being involved in the creation of, you know, any genre, you know, of literature, of fiction, of, you know, any medium can actually inform, you know, being someone who writes about that and teaches about it. And then I'd also like to make sure we get to, you know, should people be getting students to read, you know, Kismet as part of courses in order to engage with, you know, comics, to engage with Islam, to engage with, you know, contemporary politics and things like that?
I can answer the last part first. And the last, and the last part is, yeah, they definitely should. I mean, to the same degree that I'd recommend, you know, a movie in a class, or the way that I would link to a podcast that is salient to a topic in a course. Absolutely. Comics are accessible, largely speaking. They are relatively cheap. They are relatively durable, and they're chock full of ideas and such. Many, a growing body of comic scholarship is out there, so you can then link the piece that you've read to commentaries on it, to analysis, to theory. So I have long been, well before Kismet, well before even my interest in the intersection of religion and comics, a proponent of comic books usage in education at all levels, and for all learning levels, from the elementary school, public school level through graduate and postgraduate study. It is a medium that not only shouldn't be overlooked, it is a medium that actually marks where a society is at a given moment with the fewest watchdogs on it. You can get the underground sensibilities or the political sensibilities or the financial sensibilities or the spiritual sensibilities most directly through a comic as compared to the expense of film or the expense of television or even the expense of other print publications. So an unabridged yes, an unreserved yes to the second part of your question.
Yes. Well, then let's get back to the first question.
Okay.
And I'll ask it in this specific way. Can you think of an example of the sort of thing that maybe you notice when studying a comic, you know, as a subject of academic research that you think maybe you wouldn't have noticed or it might not have appreciated in the same way if you had not had the experience of being involved in creating comics?
Absolutely. When I'm reading a comic, what stands out most to me as a hybrid comic creator, comic scholar, is the amount of research that obviously had to go into a plot point or a storyline or a character's background or a setting. I mean, I was recently reading a work by Terry Moore. Terry Moore is best known for the independent comic series Strangers in Paradise. But he did this more recent work called Echo that goes into the dynamics of thermonuclear fusion and its effect on the like quantum level, just in order to tell this great spy story, right? In order to tell this great espionage story, he had to deliver this degree of knowledge. And I noticed this a lot in the works of Warren Ellis. He'll like sort of hook on to one crazy tech idea and run a story out of that. I detect that very often. And I also notice its absence. I also notice when I'm reading perhaps a superhero comic or perhaps a even more of one of those funny animal kids comics that obviously the writers and the creator and the artists didn't look outside of comics for inspiration, that it's a very insular creation, that they know how to create comics, they know how to reproduce storylines and stock characters, but what they don't have is any injection of theology, of religious studies, of history, of geopolitics, of finance. I mean, it really can come from anywhere, and that's the thing that sort of sends my antennae up, figuratively speaking. I don't actually have antennae. Figuratively speaking, when I'm reading a work, that's what I've become most sensitized to.
Yeah, I think it's only people like us who appreciate comic books and sci-fi who would feel the need to explain that our antennae are going up, figuratively speaking, right?
Well, or just explain what I meant by that. I mean, I didn't want people at home to say, "Oh, he's into cybernetics." I see. I didn't want them to take me seriously. But yes, that's definitely what I have. A growing sensitivity to, particularly from my background in academia.
Yeah, and I can think how that could transfer. You know, the same sort of thing happens, you know, you're looking at an ancient gospel or an ancient apocalyptic work, and some of them very much are drawing on that genre, but are not, you know, are not informed or not engaged with, you know, their contemporary setting, or are not historically aware in the same way that others are, where you get a sense of the richness and the depth of some of the imagery that's being drawn on.
And it's very surprising sometimes that even the most satirical comic book work that involves religion will have the most knowledge behind it. Whereas the one that's taking a very straight and narrow, direct, mainstream approach to religion has an incredibly, incredibly narrow bandwidth, has no awareness of how the particular story being relayed or the theology being expressed has interacted with other communities, either in the present or historically. So I'm always surprised. There's a particularly savage comic out there called The Chronicles of Wormwood. It is not for the faint of heart whatsoever. And you could see it as anywhere from sacrilegious to heretical. But the one thing I'll say on it, it is so well informed. It knows what it knows what it opposes, right? And I at least appreciate that aspect of it than I do the very straight and narrow, pious, basically not novel, not creative work that doesn't reflect any of that.
Yeah, I imagine that a lot of people, you know, who've engaged with religion, whether academically or just on a personal level, you know, will appreciate that. That, you know, there's nothing worse than the you know, the cardboard cutout caricature, whether it's supposed to be a positive, you know, religious character or somebody's a subject of criticism. You know, unless there's some depth and some actual knowledge of the, you know, the what actual human religious experience and expression looks like in all its diversity of forms and things, then neither the positive portrayal nor the criticism, you know, really comes across very well for anyone.
That's right. And my my alma mater, Boston University, has a special collection in religion and comics at the School of Theology Library. And the one reason I bring it up is that when you scan the shelves and you look out how many different comic book or graphic novel interpretations of the Bible, just the Christian Bible, the New Testament alone, there have been, you can see that that is not going to be a guarantor of how rich and informed it is about biblical studies. You can just hold them against each other and sort of see that this one was trying to incorporate many readings of the Bible, many interpretations of the Bible, the history of any Bible editing and so forth. And just another one sitting right next to it is just, is still trying to deliver the good word, so to speak, but was really just locked into one view, one interpretation alone, which I find much less intriguing, exciting, a much less of a full use of the medium.
Yeah. So I think Kismet is a perfect example of just how rich engagement with, you know, contemporary religion, with politics, academics, and, you know, the general public, general audience's understanding of the insights we're trying to bring, the things we're trying to study, the things we're trying to communicate, how all this can come together. And frankly, I can't think of anyone offhand who, you know, has both researched comics and created comics to such an extent that they probably could have done this. So thank you for reviving Kismet, I think is the main thing I want to say.
That is so kind of you to say. Thank you. And that is it, largely its goal. You know, I'm going to say one thing, and you can edit this out if you like. There's only one other person I can think of who has studied religious studies this closely, and I'm not calling myself a master by any means, but has studied religious studies and tried to produce a comic book work that is reflective of it. However, it's a very bad comparison. Actually, I can think of two now. Jack Chick, who's infamous for his super evangelical narrow comics, and Dave Sim, the creator of Cerebus, who has basically regards himself an Abrahamist. Many regard him as a misogynist or sexist, and has espoused his religious beliefs through a warrior aardvark. So I don't know what company I keep.
Yes. Well, just for the record, and I will let you say after I've said this whether this whole little bit here should be in this or not, and then audiences will either know or they won't. But this is Yeah, there are no warrior aardvarks in what you've produced, and nope. it's nothing like a Jack Chick comic.
I really hope it isn't. Yeah. I mean, thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
That was never, ever
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about what you've created. I'm really looking forward to this being an ongoing series and to hopefully the discussions, you know, in classrooms, in the general public, in comic book forums, among fans, you know, left, right, and center, politically as well as metaphorically in other ways, of, you know, not just Kismet as a character, but all the different subjects that, you know, he engages with as a character and that you engage through the stories.
I welcome it, and thank you for bringing some light to it.
Yeah, so I'll keep reading, and at some point maybe we'll get you back to talk about, you know, future, other volumes and the things that have happened since this this first podcast in which we spoke about the comic. So
that, inshallah, yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah, so thank you for being here, and to everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for listening. Go read Kismet, and bye for now.